WSB Stony Brook. Same bat time, same bat station.
And it's 5 minutes after 10 o'clock. You turn to WUSB in Stony Brook. Eric Corley with you. We're going to do a slightly different kind of a program tonight, kind of a tribute to a great person who passed away this week, Abbie Hoffman. We'll be taking a look at his life, taking a look at the 60s, talking with some people. Stay tuned. WUSB in Stony Brook. The whole world's watching. And that was Chicago Transit Authority from side four of their first album. Actually, Chicago, side four of their first album, called Chicago Transit Authority. August 29th, 1968. Quite a time, quite a year, quite a decade. And quite a man has departed this realm. I heard the news in my car as I was driving this week on my way to the supermarket to pick up a frozen dinner of all things. I hear on the radio, Abbie Hoffman found dead in his apartment in New Hope, Pennsylvania. And after a while you wonder, you know, are you numb to these things? You know, you hear the person's name, you hear 60s activist Abbie Hoffman, and you say to yourself, oh God, he's dead. Before they even say it, you somehow know. And you've already accepted the fact before they even say the words. What's interesting, amazing, disturbing, what have you, it's the way in which we accept this and just move on with our lives and just think, so he's gone. What am I going to wear to work tomorrow? Abbie Hoffman was an incredible person. He changed so much just by doing his bit, just by saying things, just by acting kind of crazy. This radio station would not be the same had it not been for Abbie and people like him and that whole crazy period. What we'll be doing in the next 2 hours is looking at Abbie's life, looking at the 60s, talking with some folks, and sort of sitting back for a little while and just kind of taking it all in, because it's a shock, you know? It's always a shock when something like this happens. I know when John Lennon died, it was a shock when all those folks in the 60s went. It's a shock each time. This is no less so, because with Abbie's passing, it's almost as if an entire era is now gone completely. The 60s. What is left of the 60s? Almost everything we've learned, we seem to have forgotten. And I think that's one of the things that that disturbed Abbie so much. The way we seem to ignore the past. The way we seem to be repeating same mistakes. And he was especially disappointed in the young folks of today and how they just didn't seem to care enough. And my own personal theory for that is that you need a crisis to be able to care. You need a war. You need to see your friends dying around you to really stand up and take notice. When everything is going kind of okay, you tend to not care as much about what happens in other parts of the world or about those little incursions of your personal liberties. I'm going to look at an article from Newsday this week written by Dennis Hamill, who back in 1979 was a reporter for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. I sat at my desk in the city room of the Herald Examiner in 1979 after finishing a column for the next day's edition. When I was ready to leave, the phone rang. The voice on the other end was familiar. I'm not Mickey Mouse, and I'm not Donald Duck, but I'm one of your favorite Disney characters, the man said and laughed. Guess who? I knew the voice, but I couldn't place it. After guessing Pluto and Dumbo, I gave up. Ordinarily, you hang up on crank calls like this, but I knew that voice. This is Abbie, baby, he said finally. How are you? Abbie? I said, causing a few reporters sitting near me to turn and listen. Abbie Hoffman? He assured me it was, and that there would be pictures of him with Disney characters taken in front of the landmark Hollywood sign, delivered by messenger that afternoon to my office. Now, Hoffman at that time was on the run, an underground fugitive from a New York arrest in which he had been charged with selling cocaine to an undercover agent. Oddly, a few days before, I could have sworn I had spotted him on Santa Monica Boulevard, getting into a Volkswagen van. I asked the man on the other end of the line where he had been on the day and time in question. There was silence for a moment, and then trepidation in his voice. He gave his movements concerning the day and time I had mentioned. He described the store he had left, and the location, and the time. I mentioned the van. "That goddamn plastic surgeon," he shouted through a laugh. "I should rearrange his face." He'd had plastic surgery, all right, but Abbie Hoffman had a way of catching the eye like few others I've met. In a lifetime that was essentially a performance, he had managed to elude the FBI for 7 years, a testament to his intelligence and cunning. I asked him questions about himself. Only he and I would know the answers. The one that clinched it was that we had the same literary agent at the time. He told me her name. I plugged in the recording jack. The next day, the interview ran as a Q&A on page one, along with the pictures of him in front of the Hollywood sign with the Disney characters. Hoffman had once again talked his way onto page one, something he could do even from the back pages of The Lamb. So yesterday, I was saddened to see what will probably be his last front page. In our 1979 interview, Hoffman wasn't quite his old self. I could tell how badly he wanted to surface. Beneath all of his shenanigans and pranks and media manipulations over the years, he was a sensitive and caring, down-to-earth guy. He missed his family. He missed his close friends. He liked people, and they liked him. He loved to laugh, but not as much as he loved to make other people laugh. But on the phone that day, he sounded angry and lonely. He swore he was framed for the coke bust. He talked about politics and the future. He cracked jokes, but didn't laugh at them the way he used to. There was a nostalgic melancholy that ran through a wandering interview. The 60s were over. The early 70s and Watergate were over, too. And so was a large part of Abbie Hoffman. In his ellipses, I could hear the tale of a fish out of water, flapping on the dock of history. I remember a summer day in the early 1970s in Greenwich Village, when a self-described garbologist named A.J. Weberman staged a protest outside Bob Dylan's house, claiming he had evidence from Dylan's garbage that the singer was a heroin addict. The press arrived. Weberman hoped to get all kinds of press and TV bites out of this nasty madness. Then Hoffman showed up and stood in the middle of the street. And without saying a word, he started playing with a yo-yo with masterly grace. The reporters and cameras shifted to Hoffman, who had done nothing more than play with the yo-yo. I asked him why he played with the yo-yo. "Because Weberman is a yo-yo," he said. The protest in front of Dylan's house turned into an Abbie Fest. Yo-yos became popular in the village that summer. In his 52 years, Hoffman was arrested 42 times for various political offenses. But last year, the police didn't even show up after Abbie called the Ninth Precinct to tell them he was going to illegally disperse clean needles at a disco in the East Village. A disappointed Abbie told New York Newsday reporter Bob Liff, "I can't even get arrested anymore." His most famous arrest was as a member of the Chicago Seven following the riots at the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention. William Kunstler was his lawyer in the trial. "He was a consummate political humorist," Kunstler said yesterday. I remember Judge Julius Hoffman at that trial remarking that he had once tried a case in New York, and Abbie responded that was probably when the British still had it. That broke up the courtroom. Another time he held a press conference to announce that the Yippies had discovered an aphrodisiac. He wound up selling the pills to the reporters. They were just aspirins, but he had them convinced. He could make you believe anything. What I can't believe is that he's gone. After talking to Kunstler and many of Abbie's other friends about how great a media manipulator he was, I remember just how much Abbie had used me to get to page one, and I remembered the phone call I got the next day from the head of the FBI in Los Angeles. He asked whether I would come in and talk to the FBI about Hoffman. I said I would only come if I could record the conversation. He reluctantly agreed. I met with him the next day, and he and two other agents asked me how they could contact Hoffman. I suggested maybe they should write to Dear Abbie. They were underwhelmed with the information I provided. Abbie Hoffman, who lived and died on the front page, had the last laugh in this case, too. The next day, the conversation with the FBI ran as a Q&A on page one. That article from Dennis Hamill of Newsday. Commenting on the death of Abbie Hoffman at the age of 52. Think about the TV and radio and how much coverage there has been for something like this. And I've been looking, I've been watching. I was shocked. The New York Times didn't even have it on their front page. They buried it in section D on the obituary page. That was it. It's amazing how little something like this means in mainstream America. What we're going to do now is play one report that I think captured Abbie Hoffman. It was a report that was aired on the Pacifica Network. We aired it here in WUSB. And this does a far better job of summing up what Abbie's life was all about. When we come back, we'll be talking with some people who knew Abbie and looking at some other articles and things like that.
'60s activist Abbie Hoffman died last night in his home in New Hope, Massachusetts. He was 52 years old. Doctors still don't know the cause of death. Pacifica's Alan Smithow spoke with those who knew Hoffman and prepared this report.
Many activists of the 1960s have followed Abbie Hoffman's life, hearing from time to time of his triumphs or troubles, but always seeing Abbie as someone whose life parallels their own. He is the 60s rebel of the imagination against a furtive and often murderous establishment. Abbie was the founder of the Yippie Anti-Vietnam War Party. He was one of the Chicago Eight with Tom Hayden, Bobby Seale, and others, all tried for organizing the rebellions outside the Democratic Convention in 1968. In the early 70s, he became a fugitive after being charged with trying to sell cocaine. He stayed underground for 7 years, but he always remained an activist, organizing a strong local environmental movement in upstate New York under the name of Barry Freed. Since 1980, Abbie Hoffman had his ups and downs, participating in anti-apartheid protests with students in Massachusetts, writing several books, making his debut as a stand-up comic. Some friends say he's been depressed recently, having a hard time dealing with a conservative regime in Washington and trying to find a role for himself. But the Abbie Hoffman most people remember was the man who threw money off the balcony of the stock exchange and who realized in himself the best political guerrilla theater of the 1960s. The voices you're going to hear are those of Hoffman's Chicago 8 attorney, Bill Kunstler, and San Francisco radio producer, Scoop Nisker, as well as Nancy Cohen, who is just finishing a film called Dinner with Abbie. Their comments are interspersed with Abbie Hoffman himself. Some of those comments, 20 years later, are still more than we can put on the air unedited.
And you better have your theater sing down pretty pat. Theater, guerrilla theater can be used as defense and as offensive weapon. I mean, I think that, like, people could survive naked, see?
Yeah.
I think you take all your fucking clothes off, a cop won't hit you.
He was the originator, I think, with Jerry Rubin, to a degree, of the use of political satire, political theater, to dramatize and drive home political points of view. And whether it was trying to levitate the Pentagon with 30,000 marches, or whether it was throwing dollar bills on the floor of the stock exchange, or running a pig for president in 1968, it was all great theater, but it had a very serious message.
You're talking about war! What the fuck has a picket line got to do with war? You see? But people that are into, like, a very literal bag, like a heavy word scene, you know, don't understand the use of communication in this country and the use of media. I mean, they say if they give a 10-page speech on it against imperialism, everybody, you know, listens and understands and says, yeah. But you throw a fuck of money out in the stock exchange, and people get that right away. And that goes, you know, that minute they say, yeah, right, I understand what that's about. I know what you're doing.
But because it was good theater, it got across to a lot of people who probably wouldn't have listened to our normal rhetoric, but were fascinated and charmed by this man and his knowledge of how to satirize the events of the day.
If they don't cook them, they don't know what you're doing with them. Who cares?
He once said something that I loved. He had a lot of great one-liners, and he certainly knew how to use them. He once said, all isms should be wasms. And that was sort of his, it was one of his slogans anyway. He never had an ideology. He just fought for justice wherever he saw it being trampled on.
I mean, the yippie thing, the symbol is why. That's great. As you say to Dirk, I said, why, man? Why? Join the why. You know? Why? Join the why. Bring your sneakers. Bring your helmet. Right. Bring your thing. Whatever you got. You know, why? Why do you say it, Democrats? Why, baby? That's a why. That's not a V. It's a why.
Mary Burbage, what's your position with Tom Hayden's office?
I'm his legislative aide.
Okay. Could you please just read Tom's statement?
Sure. I am shocked and profoundly saddened by Abby Hoffman's death. He was an important person of my generation, and he will be dearly missed. Okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
There's Jerry Falwell. Now, you think he's tough, hot-edged, macho guy? Wrong. I gotta tell you about the night I slept with Jerry Falwell. Warm, loving, giving, sharing. Really? You think I'm making this up? Jimmy Swaggart took pictures of the whole thing.
As I read the paper this morning and heard about it last night on the news, I thought, how many people under 30 really have any idea who this man was? I thought about myself, say, back in the 50s when labor leaders were dying, or, you know, and people would point out, this was a great man, this was a very important person, and, you know, I didn't know who they were. How many people today really know what Abby Hoffman meant to a generation, which he dubbed the Woodstock generation? In a way, he was really a crazy figure who sort of summed up all of our feelings back then.
It's such a loss. It's a loss because of a man and a friend, a symbol for possibilities of believing in the possibility of change, and that we're not all sheep, and that we can stand up and do something about our lives.
Well, I know it isn't popular to refer to Che Guevara, but I mean, in Latin America, he is the second biggest saint. And I think he said, when they asked him this kind of heavy-duty question, he said, I just want one person to pick up the flag when I drop it, that's all. That's good enough.
Thanks to NPR's Margot Adler and Gary Covino and Pacifica Station's WBAI and KPFA for their help in looking back at Abby Hoffman, who died last night at 52. I'm Alan Snitow for Pacifica Radio.
In this world where I'll belong when I'm gone, and I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone, and you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't feel the flowing of the time when I'm gone. All the pleasures of love will not be mine when I'm gone. My pen won't pour a lyric line when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't breathe the bracing air when I'm gone, and I can't even worry about my cares when I'm gone. won't be asked to do my share when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be running from the rain when I'm gone, and I can't even suffer from the pain when I'm gone. Can't say who's to praise and who's to blame when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. Won't see the golden of the sun when I'm gone, and the evenings and the mornings will be one when I'm gone. Can't be singing louder than the guns while I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. All my days won't be dances of delight when I'm gone, and the sands will be shifting from my sight when I'm gone. Can't add my name into the fight while I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be laughing at the lies when I'm gone, and I can't question how or when or why when I'm gone. Can't live proud enough to die when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone, and I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it. I guess I'll have to do it. Guess I'll have to do it while I'm here.
And couldn't think of a song that somehow is more perfect than that one. Phil Oakes, When I'm Gone. Seems to have been written for Abby, you know? And kind of explaining why he went on, what the motivation was, why those of us who are told by all sides, why bother? Why care? Well, we can't care. We can't bother when we're gone. That's why we have to do it now while we're here. And hopefully that message has come across from Abby. I know I've been affected a lot by Abby without even realizing it. You know, it's not until somebody goes like this do you realize how much they've affected you. There's a lot I wouldn't be doing if it wasn't for Abby Hoffman. And I'm sure that's true of a lot of people, whether they realize it or not. Before that, we heard the news report from the Pacifica News Service, which I think did a fairly good job of summing up Abby's life and asking a very important question. How many people under 30 really know who Abby Hoffman was? It's hard. If you didn't live through the 60s, how do you know? How do you know what an amazing effect this person had? How do you know what the Vietnam War was like? And what civil unrest and all that kind of thing? If you didn't live through that, you don't know. You can say, oh, another one of these hippie people is gone. You know, and the world is a better place for it, perhaps. But think of what you're saying. Think of what it means to be an individual, what it means to speak out and say what's on your mind, even if it's not legal or popular, to do it anyway. And how many of your friends, how many of your contemporaries would do that, would stand up to authority, would say what's on their mind? How many of you would actually stand up and say something positive about gay people or lesbians who seem to be the victims of the latest hate groups, you know. Racism seems to have died down a bit, but now with the onset of AIDS and everything, I've seen things that I never thought I'd see. How many people would actually stand up and say, this is wrong, and I'm not going to let it happen? Surprisingly few. Surprisingly few, which is a depressing thing, and I think that's what Abby was feeling. We have on the phone line Norman Bishop, who knew Abby. Norman, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, I guess you're as much in shock as most people that I've spoken to over the last few days. When was the last time you spoke to Abby?
Yeah, it actually had been a while because I hadn't been in the U.S. for a while. The last time, I think, the last time that I'm definite that I saw him and spoke to him was actually, I think, in 85 it was, at the Amnesty International Conspiracy of Hope show, the last show at the Meadowlands. And I'm fairly certain we spoke a few times since that time, but I don't remember. We ran into each other backstage, and it had been some time since we'd seen each other because, as Abby always put it, he was working the west side of the street and I was working, rather, he was working the west side of the city and I was working the east side of the city, and, you know, sometimes you don't get a chance to see people, you know, as often, as you'd like. And obviously, once they die, then you feel very, very bad.
Uh-huh.
Didn't make the effort, to stay in touch more.
I know it's impossible to wrap somebody up in one neat little phrase, but what? Give me some phrase. Give me some idea. What was Abby like as a human being?
He was a fun person, you know. I mean, I must say that I don't think we really agreed that much on politics and how one goes about empowering people to change the world. Although I think in the end, you know, I think we had, similar goals. But the reason we stayed friends, because in the end he was my friend, was because, you know, we liked one another. And I think, you know, we respected the fact that both of us had very differing views. But he was a fun person to be with when I called Johanna Lawrence and the woman he'd been with for the last, I guess, nearly 15 years. To talk to her about what had happened. She said to me, she said, you know, it's really a shame that you hadn't seen him or spoken to him in the last few months because, as she put it, he'd become very nice, and by that she meant that he was expressing a lot more of his sentiment. And to which I told Johanna that I didn't feel that way because, as far as I was concerned, you know, every time I was with him, I had a good time, and I sensed that, you know, that he liked me, and that he was a caring person, and he was concerned about my welfare. And I think, unfortunately, you know, when people are celluloid images on, you know, on television, they don't see that human side.
When was the first time you met Abby?
I met him when he surfaced, as it were, I guess in 1980. And I managed to get his home number through someone, and I called him up and told him I wanted to do an interview for a newspaper. And, you know, I went to his place and did the interview, which lasted a few hours. And I liked him, and I said that I would try to help him in his appeal. He was at that time trying to fight the possibility of having to spend a great many years in jail. And I think partially because I felt a great kinship actually with his girlfriend, Johanna, that I think we became friends. And about a year later, when he'd come out of jail, I saw him at the disarmament rally on the 12th of June in 85 or 86 in Central Park. And we hadn't seen each other, obviously, because he'd been up in jail and I'd been in other places and couldn't visit him there. And he said, you know, you've got to come up to the river. It's a great place. And the river being the St. Lawrence River, the Thousand Islands area where he had lived when he was underground. And he conned me into coming up to the river ostensibly for a holiday. And it was really, to try to lure me to help work, to work with Save the River. And in that sense, it worked, because when you went up to the river, then you saw why he loved the place and why he, risked in that way his life and his freedom by coming out from just simply Barry Freed living with Johanna Lawrence into Barry Freed, the activist who was going to fight the Army Corps of Engineers. And, once again, when we heard of his death, and I was talking to my father, one of the curious things my father said, which I think is important for people to remember, is that, once again, I think my father, because of who he is, and not necessarily because of his politics, but simply because of his own background, would have had even less in common with Abby Hoffman. But as far as he was concerned, he just said, he was a very courageous man. And I think people have to applaud him. I think regardless of your background or political perspective, you have to admire someone like an Abby Hoffman, because he did what very few people were willing to do, which is to stand up for something, and more importantly, to try to live life to the fullest. I think a lot of us forget that in life you ought to take a certain amount of risks, however small or great they may be, but you have to live life, not just get by.
Now, you knew Abby fairly well, and the people that I've spoken to that do know Abby all say that he vehemently denies. He says that it was all a frame-up, that whole cocaine deal. Is that what he said
to you?
I think
many a late night I try to get him, to confess. Come on, tell a friend. Admit it, you were really peddling coke. And, Abby always said, no. He used to insist that he was doing all of it, as he put it, for research on a sequel to steal this book. And, once again, one of the things we have to remember, unfortunately, because, by the time Abby came back up, he was a bit passé, for lack of better terms. And one of the things that got, a bit buried in the press was that, it was sometime around 1986, Seymour Hersh, using the Freedom of Information Act, got access to some White House tapes in which Nixon is talking to Haldeman. And in this tape, Nixon is referring to Abby as that Jew. And let's hire some thugs to beat up that Jew. And so it's, when you have a president who feels that way about a man, that he's talking about hiring some thugs to beat him up, then it's, I don't think it's so unimaginable that they could have set him up. And that, yes, Abby was, however foolishly it may have been to say, I'm doing research on, how one goes around, selling cocaine. Perhaps that was a foolish thing to do. But, when you listen to tapes like that, then it isn't so hard to imagine that he could have really been framed. Because that would have been a nice way to get rid of this pain in the rear. And I think it's sad that, Americans who theoretically fought for the right to dissent and to disagree with the government shouldn't applaud when somebody actually questions what a government is doing. Instead, they look at him as an unpatriotic, un-American sort of person.
What do you think made him decide to come out of hiding?
I think he was genuinely tired. He'd been on the run, for 7-8 years, and it was a very traumatic thing. You have to remember that when he went underground, he was at that time married to a woman by the name of Anita Hoffman, and he and Anita had a baby boy who was at that time named America, but America calls himself Alan these days. And, you know, he had to give up his wife and baby, which must have been a very hard thing because he was, you know, very much in love with her. And in his own way, I think he was a good father and he cared a great deal for his son. And then ultimately he and Anita had to get a divorce because when he went underground, the FBI was monitoring her whereabouts. So, you know, to protect them, he got a divorce. And then to constantly be looking over your shoulder, you know, isn't a comfortable thing. Although, once again, I mean, in typical Abby style, you know, the thing that used to frustrate the FBI and the reason, you know, in the end they really wanted him was the fact that he would, you know, pop up from time to time. You know, as an example, David Kay's, which was a very trendy little Chinese restaurant on the Upper East Side, he once threw a birthday party for himself. You know, another time he had an Abbey Hoffman lookalike contest.
When were these events?
These were all in the late 70s.
When he was in hiding.
Yeah, so he would, you know, pop up and sneer at the FBI. You know, I mean, to hold an Abbey Hoffman lookalike contest in Central Park.
Now, I believe when he came out of hiding, he was supposed to sign some kind of an agreement that said he wouldn't be an activist or something like that. Do you remember anything like that?
No, I think the only thing like that I know about is that, you know, supposedly you say you didn't make a deal, but you always make a deal in the sense that, you know, Abby didn't want to serve, you know, all the time that he was supposedly to serve. And, you know, I don't think he, quote, you know, sold out in any way. I don't think he, you know, sold anyone out or, you know, did anything that I think he would have been ashamed of. But ultimately, you know, a deal was struck between, you know, the DA's office.
Would you say he was depressed over the last couple of years trying to find a place for himself to fit in?
I don't think the depression was caused in that sense. I mean, he had, you know, a physiological problem. I mean, he was a manic depressive, and, you know, that is unfortunately a mental disease which theoretically can be treated. Position, but, you know, I mean, he was disillusioned and to a certain extent rightfully so disgusted with what he saw. I mean, Abby used to always say to me that in the 60s he used to say, never trust anyone over 30, and now he's, you know, and now his new little phrase was never trust anyone under 30. And he wrote a book, or rather he edited a book, which was a compilation of articles that he wrote for magazines while he was on the run, and that book was called Square Dancing in the Ice Age, and was called that because he saw the age of Reagan, you know, as this great ice age that had frozen America and had frozen its passion and everything that he believed in. And, you know, I know it saddened him, for, you know, as opposed to depressed him, because I think when you're depressed, you can't do anything. So I'll say he was quite sad by the fact that he would go to lecture to college campuses, and as he would say, he was more of an activist than they were.
What was it that he was doing in these last few years? What was he active in?
He was still involved with Save the River, because as much as they won their battle and they prevented the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers from, you know, destroying that beautiful place, they're still, you know, rearing their ugly head from time to time. The only other, you know, he was obviously, I think, very publicly involved in this whole CIA recruitment thing at the University of Massachusetts. And the only other issue that I was aware of was there was this plan to divert water in Pennsylvania from the Delaware River Basin, I think, to some nuclear power plant or some other scheme that the local community was very much opposed to. And Abby took up their cause, and that's why he was living in Pennsylvania at the time of his death, because he was still very actively involved with them. The group is, I think, called Delaware Unlimited. And he'd been involved with them from, I think, 83 on, so it had been, you know, obviously, a long-term relationship. And he was still lecturing on college campuses, you know, trying to, I guess, instill in the college community, which should be the most active and the most idealistic and enthusiastic and energetic, all of those things that they clearly seem to lack. And in that sense, he was good.
I mean,
there are very few people who can energize a crowd.
He did come to Stony Brook, I know, back in 1981.
Right, and he did it he came on the stage and did, you know, a flip. I mean, that was the one thing I don't think people realized. He was really a tremendous athlete. When he was at Brandeis, he was on the tennis team and the wrestling team. And he was an avid, more than an avid, he was a sport junkie and freak. I followed everything. What made him different in that sense from other lecturers was that, you know, he had this quick mind, and he was a very funny man, and he could come up with some of the best one-liners. When forced to. And I think in that sense, you know, a lot of times humor does a better job of conveying what has to be done than a straight lecture.
Now, the articles that I've been reading seem to say that while he was able to keep his sense of humor, there was something different about him in these last few years. He wouldn't, for instance, laugh at his jokes anymore. He just seemed to be a bit more, I don't know if bitter is the right word, but just...
I'm not disputing. I think when he would come back from these lectures, and I think he would get, as I said, you know, saddened or disillusioned by why the kids didn't care. You know, but I would dispute anyone who said that they didn't see him laugh. Maybe they never were with him, or really didn't know him, because, the way I'll always remember him is, you know, his terrific sense of humor and, you know, the prankster that he was and always making a joke. I mean, I always remember Abby with a twinkle in his eye and, you know, grin on his face.
Now, you described to me earlier Abby on his boat in mm-hmm. upstate New York, and I've got a song queued up here that you mentioned that he was very fond of playing very loudly. Perhaps you could sort of set this up for us and describe the scene.
No, I mean, it was, you know, the Thousand Islands are really a glorious place, and it's a shame that New Yorkers don't know of its existence, or maybe it's good that they don't, because it'll stay pure and wonderful by not having tourists come up there. And I think when you went up there, I think you realized why Abby loved the place and why he fought for it and why he was probably on many levels happiest up there, because he loved, you know, he lived in this small little cottage that had belonged to his girlfriend's family for several generations, and, you know, on the river, and you go up there and you smell the air and it's clean and there are trees everywhere. And Abby, who was, you know, like this little kid who loved toys, and one year when he'd made some money, he bought this wonderful boat, and that was the year that I'd gone up to see him up at the river, and he'd love to show people off. He'd love to show the river off to his friends, and but being the little kid that he was, and he also had in this nice little boat of his, this, you know, glorious stereo system, and he, you know, I just remember having some really wonderful trips, you know, up and down the St. Lawrence with Abby in his boat, you know, blasting Proud Mary, which was always a lot of fun.
I'm trying to picture Abbie Hoffman on his boat playing that at the top possible volume. Creedence Clearwater Revival, Proud Mary, one of Abbie's favorites. We have still on the line with us Norman Bishop, friend of Abbie Hoffman. Norman, perhaps you could tell us if there are any plans for any kind of memorial service.
I mean, the family is trying to decide what to do. I know there's going to be something in New York and something up in Massachusetts, because that's where Abbie was born and raised.
In New York City?
And in New York City, there's talk of either doing something at Strawberry Field in Central Park, for obvious reasons, because of the 60s, and also because Abbie was a friend of John Lennon's. And if it isn't held there, then it'll probably be held at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, basically because some of his friends, you know, we feel that the cathedral is a beautiful place, and its politics, if you will, or its philosophy, probably more appropriate, you know, was similar to Abbie's. I mean, the cathedral has always been very active in progressive issues, for lack of a better phrase, and it's a cathedral that it's a spiritual place without having any of the trappings or the dogmas of any particular religious denomination or sect, and so we felt that that would be a nice place.
I'm sure a lot of people would agree with that. Any other closing thoughts?
No, you know, I just, you know, I guess this is obviously a personal thing, and perhaps others either can't relate to it or don't wish to think about it in that sense. But, you know, just watching the clip, you know, the news clips on television, it would be nice if people remembered him, you know, as a person. As I said, I mean, I think if he's going to be remembered, it shouldn't necessarily be because, you know, he was the founder of the Yippies, or because he was one of the leaders of the anti-war movement. I think it's more important that people realize that there are certain things wrong with the world, and it's up to everyone to try to do something to remedy the situation. And, you know, in that sense, I mean, there was nothing extraordinary there was nothing extraordinary about Abbie. You know, there was nothing that forced him into this. You know, it's not as though there was some sort of divine revelation, or he was born into a family where it was expected that he would do these things. I mean, he's simply an intelligent man who saw a certain amount of injustice, and he felt compelled to do it. And I think most of us, when we walk about life, we do see certain things that we know in our heart isn't right. And, you know, if I realize, you know, it's a lot easier to remember someone by putting up a statue or naming something for him, but in the end it's meaningless. You know, it's more important that if you really liked Abbie Hoffman, or more importantly, if you believe in the notion that if there's something wrong, you do something to remedy the situation, that you try to live the message instead of just mouthing, yeah, I liked Abbie Hoffman, and wasn't he a great guy, and didn't he do, you know, some interesting and wonderful things.
I couldn't agree more. What better way to honor somebody than to
deliver the message.
Deliver the message, yes. Stand up for something that you believe in, and don't just sit out your life with the mundane. So many of us seem to be doing that, you know? It's really sad. Well, I want to thank you, Norman Bishop, for talking with us tonight. And I guess if there are any updates as to a memorial service, we'll broadcast them here on WUSB in Stony Brook. Again, thanks for being on the air tonight. And we'll talk to you at some other point.
Well, thanks very much. Have a good night.
We will be talking with some other folks that knew Abbie. Right now, though, what I'd like to do is go back for a moment to 1981, when Abbie Hoffman was here at Stony Brook, and just a couple of minutes of his talk. I'll never forget this. Abbie Hoffman coming to my school, where I was a student. You know, we had this this carnival, and Abbie Hoffman had given his talk, and afterwards I just saw him wandering around the carnival. I was taken with how much he seemed to be enjoying himself, just sort of watching everything, you know, the rides and the you know, things that you throw in carnivals, balls in the baskets, and, you know, that kind of thing. He wasn't just doing a politician type of tour. He was really getting into it, you know? And I was standing there on the athletic fields here at Stony Brook saying to myself, wow, Abbie Hoffman, that's Abbie Hoffman right there in front of me in my school at a carnival having fun. It was just sort of, how do you describe something like that, you know? It's when you realize Abbie Hoffman is a human being, you know? He's a real human being. And what makes him so unusual? I don't know. There should be more Abbie Hoffmans. There should be more people that that stand up for things and aren't afraid to get arrested 42 times in their life if it's necessary. There aren't many, but maybe there are a few more. Let's take a listen to Abbie Hoffman at Stony Brook. Just a few minutes. We did rebroadcast this entire speech only a couple of weeks ago. And this is a part of the question and answer session that followed and kind of sums up his view on where the 60s went and what all the activists are up to in the present day.
Most of the people from the 60s, the names... are still active, still have the same faith. I could, for every person in the media that's identified with that idea of idealism gone sour and then turned to greed because idealism and rebellion is something that you do when you're young and when you get old you really see the light so you settle down. Everyone that's identified with that very convenient mythology, I can name you 10 people from the 60s that are very well known and still very active. No problem at that. Go ahead. Mark Rudd, Bernadine Dorn, Stokely Carmichael.
I've been informed that we have two more questions left. Go ahead.
Which legislators wanted to revoke welfare release?
I don't know the names of the legislators.
The
Daily News editorial said as long as I get on it, we have to examine the whole rules and regulations. Each year it goes back for funding to the legislature. All the rules and regulations are set by Albany. And I don't know the names of the two or three legislatures. I'm not exactly told that. They just sort of say, you know, do well, you know, because this program, it's controversial as it is, you know. Rural communities don't like to have closed prisons built. Imagine open prisons that make a lot of sense.
That's it. Where can we get more copies of your book? Seriously, where can we?
I was a post-war baby and mom got the town. I was 3 years old, moved down south. Hard times written in my mother's blood with a widow's pension and a ration book. And I remember took the miner's car to the House of Commons in a cold dark void to a lockup, saving warm from the snow. Life with the lions on the radio and Churchill.
Said I never believed it could happen like this at all.
Said of Abbie Hoffman, a shrinking violet could never do what he did. People like John Brown had the same thing. Throughout history, these histrionic and aggressive people with social agendas have to be outspoken and gregarious, but they weren't always as funny as he was. Well, where are the Chicago Seven today? Well, we know where Abbie is. Where are the other six? Well, Rennie Davis, he's now 49, a co-founder of Students for a Democratic Society, became a follower of Hinduism and Guru Maharishi in the 1970s, went to work for an insurance company and is a management consultant in Denver. There you go. Lee Wiener, 48 years old. He's a partner in a Washington-based direct mail fundraising firm specializing in liberal causes. He commented recently, "I was political then, I'm political now." The father of four children, he took part in recent marches for more AIDS research and for Soviet Jews. Dave Dallinger, 73 years old. He's never stopped protesting. 2 years ago, he was back in court, found guilty on charges stemming from a 1986 anti-Contra demonstration. Dallinger writes about the politics of protest and is a regular on the campus lecture circuit. Living in Vermont, he is in contact with the other Chicago defendants, whom he remembers with great affection. Jerry Rubin, 51 years old, co-founder of the Yippies with Abbie Hoffman, now defines himself professionally as an entrepreneur. He formed a Manhattan-based company called Network America, which runs networking parties for business executives at posh nightclubs in Manhattan. Rubin has a baby daughter and refuses to discuss other members of the Chicago Seven, observing, "My protest days are over." Then there's Tom Hayden, 49, a founder of the Students for a Democratic Society. He's been a state legislator in California since 1982, author of seven books. Hayden and his wife, actress Jane Fonda, recently separated. He is considering a run for state insurance commissioner in 1990. He said recently, "I'm thankful that my sense of idealism remains." Finally, John Freunds, 50, professor in the School of Public Health at UCLA. He served during the Carter administration as director of toxic substances at the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration. A champion of environmental health issues on campus, he feels he is translating his belief into progressive ideas, his belief in progressive ideas into a different context. He has two children. One of his daughters has been a campus activist at UCLA. It's been said of Abbie Hoffman that the FBI had more information on this one person than on any other person in their entire history. More information on Abbie Hoffman, more files, more pieces of paper. And that's something to be proud of. We're doing a special tonight on the life and times of Abbie Hoffman. We'll be speaking to another one of his friends and associates in just a few minutes. And looking at a couple of other pertinent articles. You're listening to WUSB in Stony Brook. My name's Eric Corley. I'll be with you until midnight.
My Uncle Jed, he's down on the farm. He really isn't doing anybody no harm. Works all the day, he sleeps all the night. He never ever worries or gets into a fight.
That's Artie and Happy Trum, Uncle Jed Say here on WUSB in Stony Brook. We also heard from Al Stewart, the post-World War II blues, on this special program, The Life and Times of Abby Hoffman. We have T. Menkel on the telephone. Are you with us? Hello?
Hello?
Yes. You are a friend of Abby's, an associate of Abby's. You worked with him when he was known as Barry Freed, correct?
Yeah, I met Abby up on the river, up in the St. Lawrence. I live on one of the islands up there. Uh-huh. And right now I'm living in Boulder, Colorado.
Uh-huh.
And met Abby in 78 with Johanna Lawrenson. And it was on his front lawn that we formed Save the River, an environmental group to try to prevent a Corps of Engineers project from digging up the river again.
Did you have any idea who he really was when you met him?
Not at the time. I knew him as Barry Freed. He was kind of short, scraggly hair, he was stocky, and he was kind of quiet. One day, another friend of ours came along in a boat with these big, huge booklets describing this Army Corps of Engineers project, and that's when, although I think I had an idea inside that he was someone different, but he had ideas, he had solutions, and he basically taught us how to win.
Uh-huh. What kind of tactics did he have?
Well, as Barry Freed and as Abby, actually, he was really charismatic. He was very he always did things in the moment. Like when he had an idea to call a press conference, to organize, well, the first thing he did was we printed up flyers, and the Army Corps of Engineers came in their uniforms to Alexandria Bay up in the St. Lawrence, and we met them in an auditorium at a school with about 400 people. They hadn't seen that before. They were getting 20 and 30 people to show up for these meetings. So Abby did it right then and there. Let's write up a flyer, let's hand them out to everyone, and let's get people there.
Uh-huh.
So he always did things right in the moment. He always had solutions, and he made you feel like your input was worthwhile. And so that's I think that's the charisma. You know, we looked at how he did things, and then we did it themselves and were successful. And the group's still going on today, called Save the River up in Clayton, New York.
Now, did he actually start this group?
He actually started it. I mean, he was the core, the spark plug, I guess you could call him. I mean, as Barry Freed, we were traveling to Albany to meet with the governor. We went to Washington to give testimony to Congress. And he was doing this all underground. And then, of course, in 1980, he got us all together and told us who he was and said, do you want to be involved when Barbara Walters come up? And he turned into Abby Hoffman.
Why do you think he came back out into society after that?
I think he was, you know, I heard on the radio that he was, when he was Barry, he was kind of burned out as Abby. And I think he was getting burned out being a fugitive because he had so many faces going on. So I think it was kind of a relief to finally come out as Abby again.
Did he seem strained when he was Barry?
No, God, he didn't seem strange. He was funny.
No, I didn't say strange. Strained, as in
strained.
Labor.
Yeah, a little bit. You know, he'd get really tired. I mean, he hardly ever slept. Like, I mean, he was on the phone constantly to political contacts, to, I later found out, you know, selling articles to Rolling Stone and stuff, and all doing this as a fugitive, and he had a lot of different names. So he was tired, but he was incredible energy. And, you know, we had dinners a lot together and went fishing and messed around on the river, and he was really funny. One thing I learned from Abby is there was never a dull moment around Barry or Abby. Life was exciting. There was There was never room for indifference being around Abby or Barry. Just as Barry, I think he was, I think it was a little, it was easier to be with Barry. It was a little easier.
Because there
was
less,
he was a little quieter.
Less publicity to live up to, I suppose.
Pardon me?
Probably less publicity to live up to, less media hounds when he was just one person.
I think he just listened more to people.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think he just listened more, and I think also what happened up on the river is that he got something he didn't expect. He made friends, and people loved him, not for who he was, Abby Hoffman, but for just who he was, period. And I think it touched him deeply. I know it did. You know, with all of us there, Barry and Abby, he commands kind of, his commitment is so strong that I found myself with a tremendous loyalty, you know. Do you know what I mean by loyalty?
Yeah. Because of his commitment to...
he was just so committed, and he formed friendships up on the river that that were apart from his past. You know, it was like all in the present moment. Cruising on the river, swimming, water skiing, you know, and doing our work with Save the River. Combining it all, so he had a group, and he had and still does have a group of friends up there that really were strong. Different kinds of friends, you know. We weren't all real political and stuff like that. But he taught us. He taught us that stuff.
How do you think he was able for, what was it, 7 years to elude the FBI? I mean, how was he able to do that?
Well, he had a sense of humor. He was smart. And he had a lot of energy. He was always one step ahead. I think that's how he eluded the FBI. Another way I think he eluded them is that he wasn't afraid. He might have been afraid, but it didn't stop him from always taking a stand. When the Army Corps of Engineers came along on the river, he couldn't resist. He couldn't resist a battle. You know, here he was on this beautiful river up in northern New York, and all of a sudden... the omnipresent, you know, Army Corps of Engineers says, we want to dig it up and we want to do this. He couldn't resist. So his, I think he eluded them just because he was still himself and out front. And it was the last place they expected him to be.
Well, that's interesting because, I guess rumor got out that Abby Hoffman was hiding out in upstate New York.
Yes.
And they actually had an investigation. They sent a couple of agents up there, and the agents filed a report and said Barry Freed is not Abby Hoffman.
That's great.
I wonder how in the world he was able to elude them when they came up looking for him.
Well, he was a man of many talents, Eric. He was a great cook, for instance. He was one of the funniest people I've ever met. And doing this type of work, this organization, this community organizing and putting ourselves, doing stuff that we had never done, forming press conferences, etc., it's pretty easy to burn out as a citizens group. We always had fun doing what we were doing. And that was life with Abby. Life with Barry was exciting, never dull, and full of energy, full of life.
Now, did he keep in touch with the group after he came out again?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're all friends, so we had events in Studio 54 in New York. He still, you know, he was up on the river. So yeah, I haven't seen him in about a year and a half. He came to Boulder, and I missed him last year. I was down in Arizona. But, yeah, we all kept in touch. We're all friends.
Uh-huh.
We're all friends.
Uh-huh.
I really miss him.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shock for everyone to hear it.
Well, I guess I've just been thinking a lot lately about my own commitment, the times that I'm afraid to take a stand on anything, whether it's in a relationship with anything, and that's kind of how I think of Abby, is taking a stand and questioning my my own commitment, and also having a sense of humor. You know, like for me, life is too serious to be taken seriously. And Abby was I think sometimes Abby might have taken it too seriously. He it was impossible, absolutely impossible for him to walk away. And that was one of the things I admired about him the most.
We're speaking with T. Menkel, is it?
T. Menkel.
Menkel, who worked with Abby in upstate New York, Abby when he was Barry Free.
Up on the St. Lawrence River in the Thousand Islands with Save the River.
Save the River. And we're going to come back in just a moment. I wanted to play a song that I'm told was written for Abby Hoffman. It's by John Prine. It's called Dear Abby. Now, there's an interesting story behind this. When the song came out, Dear Abby, Abigail, whatever her name is, actually sued John Prine for writing it. And John Prine turned around and said, this song wasn't written for you. It was written for Abby Hoffman. I don't know, you know, exactly how that all fits in and what's true and what isn't. I might note that the word Abby on the album is spelled the way that Dear Abby spells it and not the way Abby Hoffman spells it, but who knows what that means. Let's listen to the song. We'll come back to T. Menkel in just a moment. Abby Hoffman, supposedly this song was written for him here on WUSB.
About 3 months ago, I was in Rome, Italy, not New York. I don't know what I was doing there. I was just there. And I got the sandwich one day, and they gave me a newspaper with it. It was the only newspaper they had there that was in English. And they had all the news from all around the world just crammed in the four pages. They didn't even have any funnies in there. You know, every time you turn a page, something just jump right out at you, you know. So I found an old friend in there, and I wrote her a song. It's for Dear Abby.
Dear Abby, dear Abby, my feet are too long. My hair is falling out, and my rights are all wrong. They all tell me that I've no friends at all. Won't you write me a wishing for bad luck and knocking on wood. Dear Abby, dear Abby, my fountain pen leaks. My wife hollers at me and my kids are all free. Every side I get up on is the wrong side of bed. If it weren't so expensive, I'd wish I were dead. Unhappy, unhappy, you have no complaint. You are what you are, and you ain't what you ain't. So listen up, Buster, and listen up good. Stop wishing for bad luck and knock on wood. Dear Abby, dear Abby, dear Abby, dear Abby. Dear Abby, you won't believe this, but my stomach makes noises whenever I kiss. My girlfriend tells me it's all in my head, but my stomach tells me to write you instead. Fine, noisemaker. Noisemaker, noisemaker, you have no complaint. You are what you are, and you ain't what you ain't. So listen up, buster and listen up good. Stop wishing for bad luck and don't know what. Dear Abby, dear Abby, well, I never thought that me and my girlfriend would ever get caught. We were sitting in the back seat just shooting the breeze, with her hair up in curves and her pants to her knees. I'm just married. Just married, just married. You have no complaint. You are what you are, and you ain't what you ain't. So listen up, buster, and listen up good. Stop wishing for bad luck and knocking on wood. Signed, dear Abby.
And that's John Prine with Dear Abby, and I suspect that song wasn't really for Abby Hoffman, despite what he said. But I definitely sense Abby's humor in there. I can see him smiling at that. We're on the phone with T. Menkel, who was an associate and friend of Abby Hoffman's, and Barry Freed, as he was known for the time that he was in the Thousand Islands area. Who would you say Abby Hoffman looked up to as, well, I don't want to say a role model, but...
Who inspired him?
Who inspired him? Who did he respect? Yeah.
One person comes to mind. Her name is Polly Daw. She stands about 5'2". She's got white hair. She's 77 years old. She lives up on an island on the St. Lawrence River until the snow gets over her tennis shoes. And she writes a local article in the newspaper called Camshaft Thinking. She is right out there. She's never afraid to say what she believes and what she's thinking. And she's always herself. And, Eric, I'd like to come up with some big famous people. And I know there's a lot who probably inspired Abby. But in my experience with him, his friends who just loved him for who he was and had fun with him and laughed at him and treated him equally. Not as some big someone that knew more than they, but just treated him as a friend. And ordinary working people who weren't afraid to take a stand and give their views. That's who he looked up to, who he respected, and I think where he got the most joy in his life, at least with us.
I think you've given us the answer right there. It wasn't the big famous people. It was the people like us, the people... like Abby wanted to be himself. He was happiest when he was a human being, not when he was a celebrity.
Mm.
And I think it's quite likely that many other people who find themselves in the celebrity status would really envy that.
I'm really glad you called, Eric.
It's good to hear that.
Yeah, I'm really glad you called. I've been thinking of Abby a lot lately, and He really did love people, and he listened a lot to them.
Uh-huh.
And he loved to laugh, and at the same time, laughing when you're taking a stand. And I think that's probably what I've learned the most from him is having laughter and just being myself. And while I'm being committed at the same time, I think that's what commitment is.
How do you think today's world is different because of what Abby did and what his presence accomplished?
I can tell you how I'm different.
Okay.
I'm different in that that's a great question. I'm different in that to say what I believe no matter what.
Uh-huh.
To just tell the truth as I see it no matter what, whether it's to my mom and dad, to my friends, to my local or national politician. And to know that I got the answers if I just always go with my gut feeling. That's what Abby did. He had a gut feeling based on his own experience, and that's how he operated every single day. When he had something to do, he did it right then. If it was a letter to the governor, he wrote it right then. He didn't wait till tomorrow. So I think it's just knowing that I got the answers if I have enough trust in myself to look. And if I have laughter, then I'll always get the answer I need. And to not be afraid to be committed, I don't think there's really anything else. I think everything changes with commitment, and it doesn't matter really what the commitment's to. Well, it does in a way, just to yourself, but that's what I've learned from Abby. It's all about commitment and what life is really worth living.
And to be true to yourself.
I think that's the only thing, yeah. And to laugh at the same time.
Uh-huh.
I think that's all people really want from each other, is just people being themselves, not trying to be something else. And Abby always saw who people really were. And that's how I see the world as being different.
How did he view his opponents?
How did he view his opponents?
Yeah.
He respected them, and he hated to lose.
Uh-huh.
He viewed his opponents with respect.
Give us an example of how he hated to lose.
Yeah. After the Army Corps battle, we were faced with nuclear shipments coming over the bridge, and it looked like they were going to keep coming over the bridge from Canada, and he said, well, who wants to chain hands together and stand across the bridge? I mean, he was willing to go to those lengths to put his beliefs on the line, with his body as well.
And did that happen?
That didn't happen on the bridge, no. I guess how he hated to... He never considered the possibility of losing. I think that's how he hated to lose. He never even very rarely considered it. He always had the strategy and did things like he was going to win. And I think in some ways that exhausted him too.
Uh-huh.
You know.
The later years, did you detect any kind of a change in him?
Pardon me?
Did you detect any kind of a change in Abby in the later years, the last couple of years?
Tired and exhausted. I haven't seen him. I didn't see him in the last year and a half. I think he was tired. I think he was exhausted. And I think he was real lonely.
Uh-huh. Do you have any idea what might have brought that on?
Yeah. Well, sometimes it gets pretty lonely to be so committed and to feel like not enough people are hearing your message. I don't think that was true. I don't think it's really true, but I think that's how he viewed it. And so when you look at things like that, it's real, real lonely. And
you think the new conservative movement helped that feeling?
It's hard to say. I know he's expressed that he's a little bit disappointed in college kids, you know, that they don't have the same, in his words, type of energy in the 60s, although I just think it's a matter of his perception. You know, he saw so much, whether it was in Nicaragua, whether it was up on the St. Lawrence, whether it was down in Mississippi, you know, traveling around with Medgar Evers in the 60s, and he saw how things could be. And when you look at things too much like that in the future, it's hard to accept the present. And that's how I think he looked at it.
Uh-huh. Well, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts and feelings on Abby as we remember him today.
The thing I'll miss the most is just laughing with him.
Yeah.
He was a good friend.
Yeah.
He's a good friend. Eric, I thank you a lot for calling.
Okay, well, I thank you for sharing this with our listeners.
Hey, and thanks all you folks out there. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Okay. Take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. It was T. Menkel, a friend of Abby Hoffman. Worked with Abby Hoffman on the Thousand Islands project. And Save the River was the name of the group that Barry Freed, who was really Abby Hoffman, was a part of back in the late 70s. And the group survives to this day. They're victorious in their fight to saved their river. And, wow, quite a person has left us. And again, I don't know how many of our listeners really know that, how many of our listeners were here for those days. Even if you weren't here for those days, though, you know, it's still possible to understand what he was all about. To glance at the obituary in the New York Times, which you really had to look for, you really had to search this one out. It was buried in the D section, which I almost didn't look at because that's the business section. And I was looking for Abby's obituary and wouldn't be in the business section, would it? Well, there it was. Abby Hoffman, the writer and anti-war protester who founded the Yippie movement in the 1960s and became a symbol of radical activism, was found dead Wednesday night at his home in New Hope, Pennsylvania. He was 52 years old. Mr. Hoffman was discovered about 8:15 p.m., lying in his bed fully clothed, said the Bucks County District Attorney, Alan Rubenstein. The results of an autopsy were to be announced on Friday. They were inconclusive, and they'll be performing further tests. Mr. Rubenstein said he found the body after receiving a call from Mr. Hoffman's landlord asking for assistance. We suspect no foul play, said Mr. Rubenstein. Abby Hoffman rose to national prominence with the Chicago Seven, a group of radicals who stood trial on charges of conspiring to disrupt the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. They were acquitted of conspiracy, but Mr. Hoffman and four others were convicted of crossing state lines with intent to riot. The conviction was eventually overturned. At the Chicago 7 trial, Mr. Hoffman angered the court by taking note that the presiding federal district judge, Julius C. Hoffman, had the same last name and saying the judge was his illegitimate father. Abby Hoffman went underground from 1974 to 1980 under threat of a long sentence on cocaine charges. He had plastic surgery, but nevertheless was recognizable as a renegade protester. For a time, he masqueraded through Europe as a food reviewer and then lived under the name Barry Freed in a small community in upstate New York. He surfaced again on national television with Barbara Walters on ABC. That was on September 3, 1980. The next day, he surrendered in New York City, insisting that the passions of the 1960s had cooled enough for him to expect lenient treatment. He pleaded guilty and served time on lesser charges. He again made headlines in 1987 when he was arrested with Amy Carter, the daughter of former President Jimmy Carter, in a protest in Massachusetts against the Central Intelligence Agency. In an interview at the time, he chafed at the idea that he was a 60s radical. He made his debut as a comedian in New York last summer and lectured at 50 colleges and universities a year, most recently on such issues as racial separation in South Africa and United States involvement in Central America. He gave his profession as community organizer and said he made his living primarily through public speaking. In an interview in 1987, he described his political views. "You are talking to a leftist. I believe in the redistribution of wealth and power in the world. I believe in universal hospital care for everyone. I believe that we should not have a single homeless person in the richest country in the world. And I believe that we should not have a CIA that goes around overwhelming governments and assassinating political leaders, working for tight oligarchies around the world to protect the tight oligarchy here at home." Abby Hoffman was born Abbott Hoffman in 1936 in Worcester, Massachusetts, the oldest of three children. By his own description, he was a troublemaker from the start. He was expelled from classical high school in Worcester after a fight with his English teacher and finally graduated from Worcester Academy, a private school. He then attended Brandeis University, where he was influenced by the radical social views of Herbert Marcuse. He graduated from Brandeis in 1959 with a B.A. degree in psychology. He got his first taste of activist politics a year later while doing graduate work in psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. In 1963, he went to work as a traveling salesman of pharmaceuticals, but continued to devote much of his time to his activism. He shifted his energies to opposing the Vietnam War and moving to the East Village in Manhattan, joining the hippies who thronged there. He easily identified with the restless, rebellious children of the middle class who sought to replace guns with flowers, and he broadened their form of protest. "Personally, I always held my flower in a clenched fist," he wrote in his autobiography, which is titled Soon to Be a Major Motion Picture. It was published by Putnam in 1980. "A semi-freak among the love children, I was determined to bring the hippie movement into a broader protest." He organized the Youth International Party with followers who came to be known as Yippies. They gained national attention. Mr. Hoffman moved to New Hope several years ago to join in a protest over the Point Pleasant Pump Project. It was being built by the Philadelphia Electric Company to pump water out of the Delaware River at Point Pleasant in the Limerick Nuclear Power Plant in Pennsylvania. Jerry Rubin, one of the Chicago Seven, called Mr. Hoffman a one-of-a-kind American hero. "He was a very rare person who cannot be replaced," Mr. Rubin said. "He combined humor and commitment and dedication, and his whole life stood for something." Jonathan Silvers, who co-wrote an anti-drug testing book with Mr. Hoffman in 1987, titled Steal This Urine Test, published by Penguin, said there had been no indication recently that Mr. Hoffman was ill. "I'm 27 years old," Mr. Silvers said Wednesday night, "and he would whip me on the tennis court." Mr. Hoffman also collaborated with Mr. Silvers on a book about the 1988 presidential campaign titled The Faking of the President, Politics in the Age of Illusion. It is to be published in the fall. William Kunstler, the lawyer who represented Mr. Hoffman in the Chicago 7 trial, said his client never failed to bring political satire to his causes, whether he was nominating a pig for president during the 1968 Democratic Convention, throwing dollar bills on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, or demonstrating against the Pentagon. "He taught people how to bring theater into political demonstrations," Mr. Kunstler said. "No one else but Abby has ever been able to create political protests by creating laughter." Timothy Leary, the one-time apostle of LSD, was quoted by the Associated Press as saying Mr. Hoffman was brilliant and an American legend. He was up there in the Hall of Fame with Rebel Huck Finn, Rowdy Babe Ruth, Crazy Lenny Bruce, Dr. Leary said. He was a hustler, a base stealer, a wild free spirit, and a gambler. Mr. Hoffman's brother Jack said at his home in Framingham, Massachusetts, "Abby was shy. He was only an extrovert politically, not socially." Another book by Mr. Hoffman, The Best of Abby Hoffman, is to be brought out in September by a Manhattan publisher, Four Walls, Eight Windows. It is to be a collection drawn from his previous writings. Four Walls, Eight Windows is also publishing this year a new book about the 1968 Democratic Convention by John Schultz, a Chicago writer and teacher. Speaking from his Chicago writing studio, Mr. Schultz said yesterday that Mr. Hoffman sounded tired and listless and his speech was somewhat slurred when Mr. Schultz interviewed him by telephone on Sunday for the convention book. "He acted very tired and without much energy and motivation," Mr. Schultz recalled, "but still he was responding intelligently to the questions that I was asking. What I heard in his voice disturbed me," Mr. Schultz added, "because he seemed so, I suppose, depressed is the word for it." The Associated Press reported that Mr. Hoffman's landlord, Michael Waldron, had told the police after finding his body that Mr. Hoffman had been depressed about an auto accident in which he suffered a leg fracture last June. Mr. Hoffman's marriage to Anita Kushner ended in divorce. His longtime companion was Johanna Lawrenson. And in addition to his brother, Mr. Hoffman is survived by two sons, Andrew of Braintree, Massachusetts, and America of Los Angeles, a daughter, Delia of Los Angeles, a sister, Phyllis of Mexico City, and his mother, Florence Hoffman of Worcester. Jack Hoffman said no funeral arrangements had yet been made. And again, we will announce anything that is arranged here on WUSB in Stony Brook. And though
just had to laugh. I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure he was on the house.
Christmas, come back. New York City died last year. New Year, come back. Big City died last year. Dead on her big stone feet, no light bulb shed one tear. Oh, Mr. Santa Claus, how come you're still coming round? Historic reindeer flying the same old ground. anyway, you North Pole people sure make a pretty sound. Bring me a big mass transport garbage disposal system too. Clean my police force so my boyfriends won't sniff so much glue. And I'll start giving presents and thank you for coming in blue. Last year I thought I'll never leave Manhattan alive. Year before brought up my vomit on Riverside Drive. Next year if I'm here, I think I'll bring my beehive. Honey, oh honey, I know I'm making no sense, no, not at all. Sweet molasses, forgive my anti-war grunts. Sugar, baby, this city stole my poetry pants. Merry Christmas, don't take too much hard dope. Yes, Happy New Year, don't hang yourself with a rope. Manhattan reborn, after I gave up all hope. Radiator cockroach, waving your horns at the wall. Wall, I feed you, I don't eat meat at all. Go tell Mr. Bedbug he better stay out there in the hall. And then I went out after that with my guitar playing boyfriend to McDougal Street to taste the scene there and hear what the local young guitarists were doing. And went to Gene John's in downstairs in the basement on McDougal Street. They asked us if we wanted to do a set among the amateur musicians that were coming out and playing for free on their loudspeaker system in the Stone Room basement downstairs. So I said, yeah, and while we were waiting to go on and do a turn, me and Gary wrote the next words. McDougal Street Blues. Sitting in a basement, McDougal Street Guitar Factory. Yeah. Sitting in Fiend John's Greenwich Village Banjo University. Every boy here's a genius. Plays the guitar except me. 45 years I wanted to be minstrel man. Dictated epics in books inside a Volkswagen van. Gray hair on my head, I'm singing the best that I can. Oh, Mr. Garbage Man, don't take me away. No, not yet, no. Oh, Mr. Garbage Man, don't dump truck me like an old cigarette. Not till I pick out a song you'll never forget. I tried singing mantras, I tried singing out William Blake. I tried mantra chanting. I tried tuning out old Holy Blake. Now I'll sing him the blues if good God give me a break. Back in the basement, guitars ringing all around. Screaming in the basement, guitars ring me all around. I can only play three chords. I can still sing my way underground. Listen here, children, I'm an old creep full of desire. I got a big mouth, it's because my heart is on fire. If I can get hot, you could sing like an angel choir.
Well, that was Allen Ginsberg, off a record called Allen Ginsberg First Blues, with Come Back Christmas, McDougal Street Blues. Kind of gives you a taste of the times of the 60s. It's one of the things we tried to do in the last 2 hours was sort of see what it was all like. Of course, that album came out in 1981, but that's nitpicking. We also heard from the Beatles, Day in the Life. Been talking about Abbie Hoffman, who now is no more. But I think what he did here, what he accomplished, what he inspired will live forever. And hopefully more people will not be afraid to take a stand, not be afraid to say something that could get them in trouble, but chain themselves to a bunch of other humans to prevent bulldozers from tearing something down, or stand up to club-wielding police, or fire hydrants set loose on a crowd. It's all kinds of things left to accomplish, and I'm sure Abbie would have wanted us to continue to look for them. Well, it's been an enlightening, kind of emotional last couple hours. My apologies to the folks that usually call in, because we didn't have time to take phone calls this week. We will be back again next week with hopefully a regular program where we will take your phone calls. Hope that you got something out of this, especially the younger folks that weren't around for the 60s. I mean, I was just growing up in the 60s. I was young then, real young. I mean, I didn't know what was really going on. Oh, yeah, I'd hear a couple of tunes now and then. I'd know a couple of the songs, but apart from that, had no idea. Had no idea what was really happening. And it's only through looking back at newspapers, at newsreels, some of the TV shows that are coming out these days, that you see what was really happening, what it must have been like. You can imagine what it felt like. And it was a learning decade. It was a creative and dangerous time. We can't forget that time. And we can't minimize its importance. So if nothing else, let's look to the future as an active future, as something that we'll participate in, not simply endure, not simply get from day to day, but actually be a part of it and build something, argue with people, and learn what our point of view is, one way or the other. I'm Eric Corley. I'll be back again next week. We're going to close out, and apologies to the brothers for once again taking up their time, but we're going to close out with a couple of Phil Oakes tunes. The last one that we will hear is also the first one that we heard earlier tonight, a wonderful song called When I'm Gone, which seems to have been written just for this occasion. But there's one I'd like to play right before that, which I think also applies. Love me, I'm a liberal. These are for Abbie here on WUSB in Stony Brook. Good night.
I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine.
but Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Get it? I go to civil rights rallies, and I put down the old D.A.R. D.A.R., that's the Dykes of the American Revolution. I love Harry and Sidney and Sammy. I hope every colored boy becomes a star. But don't talk about revolution. That's going a little bit too far. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Humphrey was chosen. My faith in the system restored. And I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter, don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bust my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Yes, I read New Republic and Nation. I've learned to take every view. You know, I've memorized Lerner and Golden. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. But when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I vote for the Democratic Party. They want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. And I'll send all the money you ask for. But don't ask me to come on along. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Sure, once I was young and impulsive. I wore every conceivable pin. Even went to socialist meetings. Learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser. And that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal.
In this world where I'll belong when I'm gone, and I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone, and you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone, so I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't feel the flowing of the time when I'm gone. All the pleasures of love will not be mine when I'm gone. My pen won't pour a lyric line when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here.
And I won't breathe the bracing air when I'm gone. And I can't even worry about my cares when I'm gone. Won't be asked to do my share when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be running from the rain when I'm gone. And I can't even suffer from the pain when I'm gone. Can't say who's to praise and who's to blame when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. Won't see the golden of the sun when I'm gone. And the evenings and the mornings will be warm when I'm gone. Can't be singing louder than the guns while I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. All my days won't be dances of delight when I'm gone. And the sands will be shifting from my sight when I'm gone. Can't add my name into the fight while I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. And I won't be laughing at the lies when I'm gone. And I can't question how or when or why when I'm gone. Can't live proud enough to die when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it while I'm here. There's no place in this world where I'll belong when I'm gone. And I won't know the right from the wrong when I'm gone. And you won't find me singing on this song when I'm gone. So I guess I'll have to do it. I guess I'll have to do it. Guess I'll have to do it while I'm here.
Good morning, you're tuned to WUSC Stony Brook.